From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The poet Jacqueline Oshiro doesn't get writer's block. She says that's expecting too much of yourself. And she doesn't wait around for inspiration. She writes. She sits down and sees what happens. It's not like she's not thinking about the poem, of course, not working it out. But as she said, thinking is one thing, writing poetry is another. And maybe this is why she likes stand-up comedy so much. It's a form, she says, where to succeed, you have to get awfully close to crashing. So writing a poem is a question of faith. And a little skill, too. If you don't know Jacqueline Oshiro, you're going to love her. She's joining us today, after the news. This week on Video West, you can see our latest partnership with the talented filmmakers at the production company The Good Line. We made a short doc about Jeff Metcalf. He's a local writer and teacher who's been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And Metcalf fishes all the time. He's probably fishing right now. In the film, we come along to a river, a place he describes as a safe place, a place he goes to heal. Go see it at videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I'm just going to jump in right now because today in the program, the poet and teacher Jacqueline Oshiro is with us to talk about her life and her poetry and how it is she managed to make her way here 25 years ago now in Utah. 26, is that right?
It is 26.
Jacqueline Oshiro is a distinguished professor of English and creative writing at the University of Utah. She's published 7 collections of poetry. Her most recent is Ultimatum from Paradise, which we'll have her read some from that and from other collections as well. But welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's going to seem trite starting at the beginning, but can we back up and go to your childhood in Philadelphia?
Sure, if I can remember.
Can you remember?
Yes, actually, I can.
Fondly, do you remember?
Very fondly.
Really?
And I was a very lucky child, yeah.
In what way?
Well, actually, in this last book, I have probably 2 sentimental poems to my parents, but I had extraordinary parents who were utterly devoted to their children. If I said I was interested in birds, I got taken to a bird sanctuary. If I said I wanted to learn French, my mother took me to the library and found a French book and taught me French. You know, I was a most indulged child in the most wonderful ways. And I have only the fondest memories.
Is it true your father read Tennyson?
Oh, my God, Tennyson, but especially Coleridge, The Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. Can you imagine? And 1,000 slimy things lived on, and so did I, and we're eating dinner. My father thought this was good for us. I mean, I don't know if he, how much he, I mean, I guess he must have loved poetry in his way.
Yeah.
But he thought it was good for us to hear poetry. And he read, amazingly, my beloved Emily Dickinson. That's where I first heard Dickinson, who was, the poet that sent me everywhere.
Yeah. So, was there a moment when it occurred to you, oh, this is a person who's written this thing? Do you know what I mean? Like,
oh, I was much older, not as a child.
Really?
When I was a child, I thought poetry was magic.
Yeah.
Which, in fact, it is.
Right.
But, I mean, the idea that someone actually did that, I think I was much older. I mean, really much older. I mean, as a kid, when I first got to Europe, one of the things I wanted to do was go to great poets' graves. In fact, I can tell you this is so embarrassing. But when I was in Ireland, I took a golden apple to Yeats's grave. Because, you know, the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun.
Yeah.
And I put a golden apple on Yeats's grave. And I realized much later it was to convince myself that Yeats was a person who was born and died.
Yeah.
He was a human being. He wasn't just this magical phenomenon. But I don't think I really believed it for the longest time.
It was just beautiful words.
It was so beautiful and so unimaginable that a human being could produce that to me.
You ever think about before you kind of lost your innocence in that sense, that before you started thinking about, oh, there's meter here, there's a structure here, there's a person who has a backstory who's writing about. But it was just, as you said, beautiful words. It was just magic before. That's kind of a nice way to think about it.
Yes, I almost long for those days. Yeah. I won't lie. I mean, and actually, that's the great thing about teaching.
Yeah.
Because you have students for whom it's still magic. And it reminds you, this is why I do this.
Yeah. You love to teach.
I love to teach. Yes, I do. I'm not sure how much my students love to be my students, but I love to teach them.
What do you love about it?
Everything.
Yeah.
Well, selfishly, it's such a great thing to do because you're constantly learning.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, it's, I suppose, trite to say, but really, can you imagine? I mean, you have a job in which you must constantly learn. It's thrilling to always be learning new things. I love... Well, I work with astonishingly good graduate students, so it's, I'm extraordinarily proud of them. I've got loads of books on my shelves by my students, and that's thrilling. I'm very proud. I love the fact some of them, I mean, they'll come to me, these graduate students, and they don't need breakfast, they don't need lunch, they just need poetry.
Yeah.
You know, they don't need sleep, you know, and that's thrilling. But then the undergraduates, you know, you watch those light bulbs go off when they realize things they've never realized before. Also, you watch them get better. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Learn how to express themselves, learn how to write things, learn how to notice things in a text. It's thrilling for a teacher.
At what point did you figure, I don't know the whole story, but I want you to tell me, there was a talk you heard when you were a kid, apparently, from Isaac Bashevis.
Oh, no, Singer. I was in college.
You were in college. Okay.
That's right. I think I must have been a sophomore. I remember it as a freshman, but the time I looked it up, and I was a sophomore. Yes, I did indeed hear that. Good for you.
Yeah, well, what's the story?
I mean, well, it's a great story. So Isaac Bashevis Singer, a truly great writer.
For sure.
Though his brother...
Better?
Even better.
Yeah.
And he always said so, to his credit.
Right.
But a great writer in Yiddish, right? And give him a lot of credit. This was a murdered language, a language that pretty much didn't exist, but he persisted in writing in it. And indeed gave his Nobel Prize winning speech in Yiddish.
Yeah.
But anyway, I went to see him as a sophomore in college. It was on Hanukkah, that I remember.
Hmm.
And in the question and answer, someone asked him, there were two great questions. One was, they asked him, what do you think of the future of the Yiddish language? And he said, he really did say, ask me first if it has a present, which was fabulous. And then the other thing was, they asked him, they said, what makes you want to write a story? What are the qualities a story has to have? And he said, well, it should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, which, you know, that's fine. And then he said, and I should be the only one that could write it. I remember even as, I mean, what was I, 19 maybe?
Yeah.
And I thought, right, you should only write what only you are going to write. If someone else can write it, let them. You have to write your poems. In my case, poems, stories, whatever, plays.
Yeah.
But for me, that was a revelation, and it's something I have really tried so hard to hold on to. If it's something someone else could write, don't even waste your time. And, well, do people want to write the things that – want to read the things that only I write? I don't know. But I'm good. Those are the ones I'm going to write.
Wait, that's the thing you tell the students, though, right?
I tell my students exactly the same
thing.
Yeah, I say, if someone else can do it, let them.
Yeah.
You do what only you're going to do. But no one else would put together in that way but you. And I think that any artist, surely that should be a goal, right?
But is it – is it someone else's voice for a while until you do figure that out?
Oh,
like, was it Dickinson
goodness.
For a while for you, or somebody? Or?
Unbelievably. Yeah. Right, when I was in high school, I imitated Dickinson. But believe me, not very successfully. But I tried. And you do have to imitate. In fact, there's another story I adore. It's about Chuck Close. And he told the story that when he met de Kooning, the great painter, he said, it's so great finally to meet the only person who's painted more de Koonings than I have. Which is, you know, it's such a great story.
Right.
But that's the point. And you do learn by imitation. And I think everyone imitates. But if that's all they do, that's going to wind up being a problem. You do have to find your own voice, for better or worse, you know. And I always kind of say, I mean, the great thing about being a poet is that you must use your voice. You've got to be yourself. That's also the worst thing about being
right.
You know, frankly, I would rather sound like Emily Dickinson. I can name you lots of poets I'd rather sound like. But, you know, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? when did you find your voice? Can you pinpoint it? Was there a time?
Oh, that is such a great question. You know, I think I would probably have to say it was in college when I started writing poems that were connected to the Bible, to Jewish things. I wrote a poem. It wasn't very good. I ended up using one line. It must have been two pages. One line from that poem wound up in another poem that I eventually published. But a poem in which I talked about Chagall, right, a very Jewish painter who kind of found his way. But, you know, you couldn't look at a Chagall and not know where he came from. But I remember as a child, my father would, you know, he was born in a little Russian shtetl. He came as a baby, but he was born in one. And I remember being, you know, stood in front of a Chagall, and my father said, "That's the village I came from." And I really thought my father came from a place with like purple goats, you know, where people, you know, were flying through the air in bridal gowns. You know, I mean, but that was what he used to say to me. But I think that, so when I started writing those Bible poems, those Jewish poems, is when I realized, oh, that was my voice. That's how I was going to sound. In fact, I have a brand new poem, I wouldn't call it finished, in which I've taken lines that I wrote in college in a poem that excited me and my teachers very much, but was terrible. But it was me, you know, but it was awful. But the beginning wasn't terrible. Yeah. And I've actually just now written a poem from those lines in which I say, you know, I started this 40 years ago. A little scary, 40 years ago. But what are you going to do?
It's interesting. You say that you became a poet in part because of the culture, your culture, right?
Absolutely.
Being Jewish?
No question.
But in what way?
First of all, there's this notion of a holy language. Yeah. If you grew up with the idea of a holy language, I mean, that privileges language in a way that nothing else does. So there's that. There's also being taken to synagogue and hearing these amazing words. I did love the Psalms.
Yeah.
You know, he who has clean hands and a pure heart. You know, I still remember sitting there and knowing I had neither one, you know. But what are you going to do at 4 years old, you know?
But it sounded great.
It sounded great.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then, of course, Hebrew school, and we had to learn another language. And that was thrilling for me. I loved learning languages as a child. And I remember in Hebrew school studying Bible. I was 9 with a genius teacher named Tzipporah Gelman. And she was the one who let me see that a word could mean this or it could mean that. And the verse could be interpreted this way or it could be interpreted that way. I mean, my head exploded. That was thrilling to me. As a 9-year-old kid, I was a weirdo. There's no question about it. But yeah, I remember all this stuff really very, I mean, not clearly, but intensely, probably inaccurately, because apparently all memories that we return to are inaccurate.
Was any of it a devotion to a god, to God?
Well,
was that part of it, or was it more the lyricism?
I mean, I'm sure when I was a little child, I believed in God. I must have, right? I took all this stuff seriously. But also, you know, you have to understand this notion. Books were holy, right? They would bring around the Torah scroll. You had to kiss it. Yeah. When it came around, if you dropped, God forbid, a holy book on the ground, you picked it up and kissed it. This is how I was raised. You know, you stood up when they opened the holy ark, which contained what? Words, holy words. So this was the idea. I think the thing that really appealed to me was the notion of sacred language, holy text, words containing holiness that you had to be in awe of. You know, in synagogue, you have to get up and bless the words before you're allowed to chant them. Mm. I mean, think of what that does to a little kid, that you have to bless words. I loved all. I mean, I think that's what really got me. Surely I believed in God as a child.
Yeah.
I mean, I must have. But
I think the words.
I was really excited about the word. That's what I remember being excited about.
There's a piece you wrote. I'm not sure how long ago it was. You were talking about how Americans think about poetry. and what you said was the not much.
Not much. Exactly. Right?
I mean, Americans are, they don't have the same kind of affection for words that you're talking about.
And if you go to other countries, I mean, I'll tell you about a dinner party probably 30 years ago in Italy. Hmm. Somebody mentioned Leopardi. Who was at the table? Someone who's now a math teacher, two people who now work at the post office, one is a city councilman, one was a French teacher. Somebody mentioned Leopardi, somebody mentioned To Sylvia. They all start reciting it. People dropped out. By the end, the only people who could finish it were the math teacher and the French teacher, but they could just at a dinner table recite all of To Sylvia. Can you think of any American poem that a table full of people who have, you know, a variety of jobs, doing a variety of things, could quote?
All in unison at a dinner table.
You think there's one? people might be able to start whose woods these are, I think I know. I don't know how far they could get. But I mean, honestly, we're not educated to care about poetry in the United States, which is a pity because we have great American poets. I mean, we've named Emily Dickinson. She's certainly not the only one.
No.
But we don't. That's just not part of our culture to care about poetry, which is a pity,
yeah.
I think.
Before we head into a break, I want to have you read something. And I'm thinking about Psalms. Looking Through the Window. You want to
talk
about this?
That's my Utah Psalm. It's
a good way to get us talking about you coming here.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Well, yes, exactly. Because, you know, I'd heard about mountains my whole life, but I honestly didn't know what was truly meant by them until I lived here. What it mean, and I'm still thrilled by them. Look, you should see, everyone, the view gets to have in this office. But so I had decided to write this series of psalm poems largely because I started teaching the Hebrew Bible as literature. I knew that all the great English poetry was based on psalms because I knew psalms, but I knew them in Hebrew.
Yeah.
So I had no idea until I started teaching them in English from the King James how much the language of all great English lyric poetry, or a great deal of it,
isn't
comes
from
psalms.
Isn't the King James great, though, don't you?
It's the greatest.
It's so great.
By far the greatest. We can talk about that for the rest of the time.
Right.
But yes, it's the greatest. Yeah. It's one of the great translations in existence, certainly that I know of.
Yeah.
Certainly the best translation into English that I know of, by far. But it's truly great. But anyway, so I started to write this series of poems based on Psalms. And this one, in no way could I have written it had I not lived in Utah. So this is maybe my first Utah poem. Maybe not my first. But anyway, it's the ninth in this series of Psalm poems. It's called Looking Through the Window, Psalm 121. And it has an epigraph, which is my translation, not because the King James isn't a million times better, but because I want you to get the text as it comes to me.
Yeah.
Right. And the verse is quite different in English. So in Hebrew, or my version of the Hebrew, it's, I will lift my eyes to the mountains where my help will come. My help from God who makes heaven and earth. Was it Jonathan Edwards who'd repeat continually one verse from the Song of Songs for an entire day? I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valley. He believed that in the repetition, he could hear Christ's voice replace his own. And while a God who'd use that kind of self-description would put me off, mine asks sarcastic questions like, where were you when I laid earth's foundations? I'm also given to wild expectations. Here's my secret. Help does come when you invoke it with the hills or even hum the melody for that one bit of psalm. It's the sheer idea of lifting up your eyes, the heady speculation that the mountains rise purely for the sake of lifting us, as if the endless business of creation required even our participation. But wouldn't we know it? It's a wild notion. Besides, it's no mean trick to lift your eyes. And I've been making an untenable promise in my impatience to repeat the phrase that requires nothing of me. Help will come. It is an extraordinary claim. I will lift my eyes to the mountains. Pure momentum could make anything happen after that. Unless it's part of a triumvirate. Lifted eyes, my help, the mountain's height, all approximations for the undiluted and various emergences of God, a little like gas and liquid and solid versions of something wholly without substance. But then, is it my failing? There is a chance that all I'll know of real deliverance is these blue-white mountains out my window, still reeling from this morning's blast of snow. They're uncannily beautiful without the Hebrew. So why don't I leave well enough alone? Surely it's enough, a diamond-studded mountain. Why insist on making it a stand-in for what, if we could lift our eyes, we'd see? What help do I need? What is wrong with me? A lifted eye, a lily of the valley.
Can you imagine when you first got here and you were taken by these mountains, though, that you would stick around. I mean, and why did you? Was it, I mean, the kids have school, it's circumstance, or why?
Well, no, I stuck around for a lot of reasons. First of all, I was extraordinarily lucky. This was my first job, was in one of the best creative writing programs in the country. My colleagues at the time were Mark Strand and Larry Levis, two of the very best late 20th century, in Mark's case, early 21st century American poets. I could not have been luckier to have this job. That I fell in love with Utah, it's surprising given where I was coming from. In fact, I remember, I'm going to say this, I probably shouldn't, but when I first saw that job list, there were a lot of jobs in 1989. It was a much easier time for a would-be English professor to get a job than it is now. But I remember when I saw the job list and I said, I used to say to people, my nightmare is that I'm going to have to choose between Mississippi and Utah. Because, I mean, they both, I didn't even know there was a creative writing program in Utah. What would I know about you? I don't think I even knew there were mountains in Utah, right? East Coast people don't know anything. But Utah turns out to be the most amazing place to live. It's extraordinarily beautiful, which never stops thrilling a person. The weather is sublime if you like four seasons, which I do.
Yep.
I have amazing students all the time because I'm part of a great program. So, yeah, I love
it here.
What's not to love? Exactly. I even became slightly fit, right? Something I never would have dreamed. You live in Utah, you got to be fit. I hike, I snowshoe, right? So,
all right, well, I want to have you read one more before we head to a break. I take it back. We're going to go to a break. Let's just hearing news from the Temple Mount in Salt Lake City.
Oh, okay.
I love this poem.
Oh, I'm so glad you like it. Well, I
and
do
it's
need
so
to...
funny too.
We try. Right. Well, it starts with an old joke, but which I like to say, you know, everybody in New York knows, but maybe not everybody in Utah. But a couple of things need explanation.
Yeah,
there's
please.
A Yiddish word, Meshuggeners, right, which is crazy people. And there's also, it alludes to the fact that in Islam, there's some question about whether it was Isaac or Ishmael on the altar when Abraham was about to perform his sacrifice of his son. I think that's all you need to know.
Well, there's a bit of tongue-in-cheek sort of defiance here at being referred to in the only place where a Jew could be referred to as a Gentile, right?
Well, we're called Gentiles, but I myself say, you know, you can call me whatever you want, but I'm not a Gentile. Okay, but yeah, they call me that. But we'll see as we go on what goes on. Also, I guess everybody knows that Utah considers itself Zion. So
I think everyone knows
that.
What was going on when you wrote this?
Oh, alas, I think it was probably the second Intifada. Now, alas, we're in the third. So I think that's what I was hearing. Because it's called Hearing News from the Temple Mount in Salt Lake City, and there was violence at the time.
Right.
A good deal of it. So some things don't change much. But okay, so Hearing News from the Temple Mount in Salt Lake City. You know that conversation in the elevator in the Catskills? How one woman says, "Oy, the food here is so terrible." And the other, "And the portions are so small." It's a variant on Jacob's line to Pharaoh when he gets to Egypt. Few and evil have been the days of my life. Naturally, he's our chosen namesake. This Israel, the Torah keeps forgetting and calling Jacob as if it doesn't trust his cleaned up name. Obviously, he's the perfect guy for us. We're always willing to take something over nothing. Hence our lunatic attachment to that miserable pinpoint in the desert, where now, whether it's Ishmael or Isaac on the altar, there's an ear-splitting crowd working to drown out every angel until Abraham fulfills his sacrifice. It's none of my diaspora befuddled business, but I'm not in the mood to celebrate. Call me thin-skinned, but I can't get used to the idea that all these hordes of people wish me dead. You have to remember, I'm Jacob's offspring. I want as many evil days as I can lay my hands on. Thank God I live in Salt Lake City. Who's going to come looking for me here? In this calm Zion, where a bunch of blonde Michiganers think they're the chosen people of God. Good luck to them is all I have to say. Let them get the joy from it that I do.
Jacqueline Ochereau. Her most recent book of poetry is called Ultimatum from Paradise, and she'll be back when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the poet Jacqueline Ochsner is joining us. In Utah now, though raised in Philadelphia, used to think of herself as an urban poet, but this place, as we've been talking about, the mountains have changed her perspective some. She's joining us. Her latest book of poetry is called Ultimatum from Paradise. The Holocaust. You've talked about how, and I want, maybe this is the case for a lot of Jewish families, is they talk about the Holocaust when their kids are really young, maybe too
not
soon.
Anymore.
Not anymore.
I think it was my generation. Yeah. Everybody was so stunned. They didn't know how to deal with it or handle it. They were all...
So they just talked about it.
And yeah, in these ways. But they were trying not to let you hear, but that you just heard and asked questions. And my parents weren't people to ignore their children's questions. But it was unfortunate, really, I think.
Did it scare you?
Well, I was confused. Huh. I mean, I say that, and I have a brand new poem which I say this. I actually was afraid to take a shower because I thought gas might come out. And when my mother told me the story, you know, she must have said, well, these people went to take showers, and instead of water coming out, gas came out, which I thought meant the showers were broken. It did not occur to me that people did this to them on purpose. It would not occur to any child. Yeah. So I thought showers were dangerous places. They were faulty, you know. So, I mean, just to give you an idea of my warped childhood, I think that'll do it, actually.
When did you there are a couple of poems, actually, that get to the Holocaust. There's one in particular I want you to – this is called Brief Encounter with a Hero, Name Unknown. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you something about a poem that you wrote, Psalm 37 at Auschwitz.
Uh-huh, yeah.
There's this question where you're asking, did they at Auschwitz recite psalms? Could he have tried before his slow death from starvation to bring himself a little consolation by reciting all these psalms inside his head? And you ask your father-in-law. In fact, in the poem, you ask your father-in-law.
In real life, I think I ask my father-in-law.
Yeah, like, what do you think? And he kind of, what kind of a question is that? But would you talk about this poem? I think it's terrific.
Oh, and, thank you. Well, this poem, it contains, well, it's very long, I don't think we could read it. But, well, you know, there are a couple of
read
lines.
This section of it. I could try asking my father-in-law.
I could try asking my – sure.
Do you want to say something about that, though? I mean, it's just – again, you're asking him this question. He's like, what kind of a dumb question
is this? Well, we'll see. I mean, I think everything I had to say, I tried to put in here. So we'll see if there's anything that needs explanation. So I can just read it. I could try asking my father-in-law if in all his years at Auschwitz-Birkenau he ever once overheard a psalm. But I know the answer, just imagining him giving me the slightly baffled stare he keeps in reserve for these conversations, that says, where do you find these foolish questions? And then, how could you know? You weren't there. If I hadn't been, I wouldn't believe it either. Aloud, he'd tell me, psalms I didn't hear. You were lucky to put two words together without some SS screaming in your ear. But this was nothing. This was nothing. Most of his descriptions end like this. He almost never says what something was. Whatever it may have been, he'll always sing. Yeah. And that's true. He would always say, this was nothing. He'd tell a horrible story and then say, but this was nothing. That was the way he talked. And they, by the way, never spoke about it until the movie Shoah.
Wow.
And they didn't even – we begged them, you have to go to the movies and see this. They wouldn't go. But when it was on PBS, when it was on their TV sets, they all watched it. And then they suddenly started talking. And then they even went back. They went back to Auschwitz and visited.
Wow.
It was kind of extraordinary. Yeah.
There's a poem I mentioned, Brief Encounter with a Hero, Name Unknown. There's such a fascinating story related to this. I mean, you wrote the poem when this woman was anonymous.
Well, to me, she was anonymous.
Right.
She was not. I mean, had
to you,
done
I mean.
Any
yeah, yeah.
research yeah. in the world, I would have known her name, Francesca Mann. I would have known that loads of people had written her story in various. Well, there were poems there, prose, Bobrovsky. I forget what it's called. Anyway, very well known piece of prose. Anyway, but I just asked my father, though, this was again post watching. Yep. That movie, he started telling me stories, and I asked him, what did I ask him? I guess that, well, he obviously had to work for someone in the SS, they all did, so how well did he know the boss for whom he worked? And then he proceeded to tell me this story, which I thought existed entirely inside his head, right? Because most witnesses of everything died. So I was kind of amazed that it was a famous story. I guess it happened in front of a lot of people. Who told it later or remembered it. So the only thing you need to know, which I think probably people know, is that Zyklon B is the name of the gas used to kill people in the gas chambers. This is a Brief Encounter with a Hero, Name Unknown. It could have been a matter of modesty. It could have been the gold sewn in your dress. You might even have feared for your chastity. Maybe it was simple recklessness. Perhaps you couldn't part with that one dress, once rumpled by a skillful, knowing beau, or were wearing it to hide a gaping abscess, or were pregnant and ashamed to let it show. Maybe you'd seen a Western dubbed in Polish or Yiddish or Czech or whatever it was you spoke and remembered some hokey John Wayne flourish that downed four outlaws at a single stroke. Maybe you were an unexceptional girl who'd gone crazy on the claustrophobic ride. Maybe you had had a lover's quarrel and for days been contemplating suicide. You could have been a fighter in the woods who drilled this tactic over and over and over. Who knows? Perhaps you thought you'd beat the odds. Maybe it wasn't even the right maneuver. My father-in-law mentioned it in passing when I asked how well he'd known his SS boss. His job in Birkenau had been delousing. They also used the Zyklon B for lice. And he named one Schillinger, SS, and told how he had watched Schillinger die when a new woman ordered to undress. You were going to the gas chamber, apparently. Instead, grabbed hold of Schillinger's own gun and killed three other guards along with him. Such things, says my father-in-law, were common. Needless to say, in seconds you had joined them. It could have been a matter of modesty. It could have been the gold sewn in your dress. You might even have feared for your chastity. Maybe it was simple recklessness. By the way, that piece is called The Death of Schillinger. I remembered it as I was by Bobrovsky.
Well, it turns out, as opposed to when you wrote the poem, a story told by your father-in-law, that it's the story that people know. Google it. You can research it.
Yeah.
All that stuff. Francesca Mann.
Exactly.
October 1943.
A dancer. Exactly.
And did that change?
Well, it stunned me.
The poem?
No, it didn't change. I mean, I wrote the poem under a certain circumstance.
Sure,
the poem's what it is.
Yeah.
But it stunned me that this existed in the world. That I had written about something that existed in the world where I thought it existed inside two heads, my father-in-law's head and my head. And that there were people out there who knew about this stunned me. And I found out about it in a book, After Auschwitz by Susan Gubar. She wrote about a lot of Auschwitz literature, and she assumes that I know all the other stories and that I'm telling my version. And, you know, no, I didn't. I really didn't. I had no idea. I'm even on some Holocaust survivor's website as a liar buying into these myths, you know.
A Holocaust denier.
Kind of, you know, I think it's got swastikas on it. Somebody found it and sent it to me. And I was horrified and then just decided to forget about it.
Yeah. You, you're not crazy about the word spirituality. But you've said this. You said that you're very interested in the non-material world.
That's right. That's true. So maybe
so what does that mean?
Well, I mean, it means anything, right? That's the great thing about it. It could mean absolutely anything. But I mean, I just think that...
So that's what you like about it, is that
it's
whatever.
Open.
Yeah.
Right. But I think just things as they are, much as I love, you know, realist fiction and, you know, I love realism as an art form. I just think being only interested in what's in front of your eyes is too limiting. I mean, I guess what I'm talking about is the imagination.
Yeah. I would have taken you for more of a skeptic, though. No?
Oh, of course I'm a skeptic.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But then there's that other part that you're fine with. I mean,
just a complete, when it comes to religion, I'm a complete hypocrite. I embrace my hypocrisy. I adore my hypocrisy.
Yeah. I mean, you keep kosher.
I know, insanely. Makes my mother happy.
Right.
I'm very sentimental.
Yeah.
It makes my mother so happy that she would feel like such a failure if none of her children had kosher homes. She would think she was a terrible mother. So I make her think, well, she's one third. No, I'm joking. She's a fabulous mother. But it really, really matters to her. And I guess at this point it must matter to me. Because, I mean, it's a lot of trouble.
Well, I mean, you said this. You said my people did it for 3,000 years. I'm not going to be the one who stops.
Well, that's exactly right. It's my sentimental. You know, I visited Eastern Europe in the late 70s, and I was lucky enough to be able to visit a cemetery. Yeah. But I mean, most places you go, the cemeteries are gone. But I mean, you know, I was young. What was I? 21 or so. And I see that, you know, if an Irish American goes to Ireland, they get to see Ireland and Irish people. But if I go to Eastern Europe, I'm lucky to see a cemetery. And that's when it struck me, if I want this culture to continue, I'm stuck doing it because everybody else is dead.
Yeah.
My culture doesn't exist exactly. Not in its original spot. I mean, my culture being Eastern European.
Of course,
Judaism.
Yeah.
So
this is what you love about Yiddish, too.
This is what I love about Yiddish. It's all four of my grandparents' native language, you know. And I heard it growing up. And my joke about Yiddish is that I understand the logic of the language, but not its vocabulary. Right? But I mean,
it's so packed with irony that the sentiment of like, I'm thinking of the comics. I'm thinking of the Borscht Belt
I
comics,
love I
packed
love them all.
With irony. And
absolutely.
They...
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely, yes, it's packed with irony. In fact, actually, I'll tell you a funny story. My daughter taught Hebrew school, and she taught, she taught about Yiddish. And she told them that, you know, it was a mix of Hebrew and medieval German. It's very sarcastic. So when she gave the kids a test and said, what two languages is Yiddish a mix of? And they said, Hebrew and sarcasm, which is, you know, not bad. But yes, it's a great language in which everything means its opposite. The way to say an idiot in Yiddish is to say a genius. You say, oh, a genius, meaning what a dope. You know, everything is
it's all in the
inside
delivery.
Out. It's all in the delivery.
Yeah.
Right. There's a great joke. I don't know if we should go there. But yeah, there are jokes.
You can go there.
Well, no, there's a great joke about
it. It's just starting to occur to me that delivering Yiddish is also about the timing, right? It's like comedy.
Right. Well, of course. Well, yes. Well, anything is about the time.
I guess that's true. Right?
Isn't it? We hope. But no, there's a great joke about, in fact, we know, you know, let's say that, I guess it's Stalin who's in Red Square and he gets a telegram and he says, I have received a telegram from Trotsky and it says, you are right. I was wrong. This is socialism. And a little Jewish guy in the crowd, like, raises, you'll excuse me, Your Honor, Your Excellency, but I don't think you understand how to read this telegram. So he takes a telegram and he says, you are right. I am wrong. This is socialism. So that's actually become our joke in our family. Whenever we're fighting, we'll say, this is socialism, meaning you're wrong. You're very wrong about that. So anyway, yes, it's all in the delivery.
Yeah.
It is, and that's where those Borscht Belt comics come from, all of whom I adore.
Yeah.
I go on YouTube and watch Henny Youngman. It's a joy.
Jacqueline Ostro is with us. Her most recent book of poetry, which we'll get to, by the way, when we get back from a break, is called Ultimatum from Paradise. We'll take a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the poet Jacqueline Ostro. We're talking about a lot of things, actually, and we're going to have her read from she's been reading some of her work, but from her latest, which is Ultimatum from Paradise. So you've talked about how poetry collections – you don't think of them as collections. Is it just a poem at a time, or do you put them in themes, or how does it work?
Well, no. I mean, this one, I mean, I got crazy about architecture. I don't know that I'm going to read. Those are pretty long poems. And there's a whole section in which architecture is very important. But I work on one poem at a time. I think these sort of project books often have the reverse effect from the one they're striving for, which is to say somebody comes up with a project and then he's stuck filling it in. You know, if you have a project, I'm going to have a number, a poem for every number from 1 to 20, then you're stuck, oh my God, I haven't written 19. Okay, now I have to write 19. You know, you know what I mean? Whereas my poems aren't written that way. Yeah. I'm not trying to fill in. I get obsessed by something, try to make some connections, see what happens. Keep trying, you know. But I mean, I write one poem at a time usually. I'm not trying to think about the other poems that are going to be around it. My thinking is if I wrote it within a certain amount of time, they all probably go together one way or another. I'm not thinking about the other poems around it. And this, I'm unlike my students. There's a big push now for sort of project books, but I discourage them from it, to be honest.
Why? Because
as I said, I think what you end up doing is sort of filling things
in, of course,
rather than, you know, writing the poem you need to write next, the poem you really care to write that matters to you.
You said something that was so interesting. You said thinking is one thing, writing poetry is another. And it was in the context of that thing that I mentioned in the introduction earlier, which was that you don't get writer's block and you don't just wait around for inspiration. You're like, come on, let's get on with it, right?
Right. You know, I work and I throw out a lot of stuff, needless to say.
Yeah, of course.
But, I just keep at it until I hook myself. But right, you do have to think. I do have to think when I'm writing a poem. I'm not one of these people who says, well, I'll write it and I'll figure out what I meant later. That's not my approach. I'm trying to figure out where I'm headed. Now, when you're writing, though, thinking becomes a different activity.
Yeah.
Because you're writing you're sort of thinking in a way in language, which is not exactly thinking. You're going places. And often you have no idea where you've found yourself. You know, you're utterly lost. You say, oh my God, how am I going to get out of this? And then you have to figure out how to get out of it.
Yeah.
But it's those actually.
But wait, is that the so I'm trying to make it, I'm this is a stupid distinction and I know it's not right, but I'm thinking a distinction between the writing part and the thinking about it part.
Right, well, you do them both, but sometimes simultaneously, but often not. Often I'll be in the middle of something and think, you don't know what you're doing and you don't know where you're going.
Right.
You have to stop and think about this. What is it that is at stake here? What is it that matters to you here? And sometimes I have to do that. Other times, something will occur to me in the course of writing. You know, that's where I think people get this idea of a muse, because you think, oh my God, where did that come from? I should go with that. Let's see what happens with that, And so things will occur to you in the process. And that's one reason I love sometimes writing formal poems, because the sound, you have to make a sound. The sound will suggest something to you. The place you have to go next. You have to repeat a certain word. You have to repeat a certain line. It will make suggestions. You sometimes, it's like a map. Mm. It gives you a sense of direction. You write in free verse, which I also do.
Yeah.
What do you do now? You can do anything. It's terrifying. You know, you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So it's that sort of thing. But
let's I want to have you read from the new collection.
Okay.
Golden Oldie is terrific.
Oh, sure. Okay. I'm afraid, and this will be a crazy thing to do on the radio, but I always read this poem the way I hear it. So I'm warning you now. Okay. This one is a sonnet. So this is Golden Oldie. Even now, I can't hear the organ intro to Percy Sledge's sultry "When a Man Loves a Woman" without that afternoon returning full force. It's on the radio. You're painting, plastering the little bedroom, and I'm giant pregnant reading Middlemarch for my PhD exams on the glassed-in porch. And suddenly you crank up the volume until the entire house begins to shake. Don't tell me there's no such thing as happiness. You racing down the stairs, ecstatic, shouting, "Listen to this, listen to this." Your whole heart audible, mine pumping fast. We were young, infallible. It wouldn't last.
I'm glad you sang there. That's great.
That's how I hear it. I have no choice. I'm sorry. I apologize to Percy Sledge, who sings it a lot better.
A lot better?
A lot better.
I know one of your passions, one of the things you love, is visual art. You spent some time in Florence.
Yes, lucky me.
Yeah,
yes,
lucky you. Now, I don't know if that has anything to do with White on White.
Of course it does.
I was going to say.
It has a lot to do with White on
right?
White. I even mention it.
Yeah. say something about this poem. I mean, I think people will get – maybe that's an annoying question for a poet. Say something about this poem and then read the poem. But where were you coming from when you –
Where was I coming from? Well – you know, it's again, I as I think I mentioned, I go for realism. My own approach is to write about things that actually happened, to write about the world that presents itself to me. I don't make things up. So nothing in here is made up. It is entirely true that I had the hiking experiences that are described eventually in this poem. And it's entirely true that I made the connection to a painting that's not my thing at all.
Yeah.
So it was, for me, a really interesting experience to write a poem about a painting that it's a great deal of work for me to love. I now love it very much because it suggested something to me, which enabled me to get it finally, to get what Kazimir Malevich was doing when he made his painting White on White. By the way, he has some paintings. There's one of the Red House. It's spectacular. So that are a little bit more representational, a little bit more my thing. But, you know, he's a great painter. And this turns out to be a great painting, but for me it was a lot of work to find that out. But when I did discover it, I thought it would make for an interesting poem because it's so much not my thing. And it's great, you know, to write against yourself. That's the excitement, really, finally,
yeah.
I think. So that's what I was trying to do here. Is that enough?
Of course.
Right. So should I read it?
Please.
Okay. So White on White, after Kazimir Malevich. I mentioned MoMA. Of course, you know it's the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Okay. It's the sort of painting I could never stand. A white square askew on a white background. One more aesthetic incarnation of that swindled emperor, naked again, preening in his non-existent clothes. I'd lived in Florence, where painting breathes, seen how inanimate materials, gold beaten to dust, crushed up jewels, mixed for rich and lasting color with albumen, could be converted into pure emotion. How master after master after master had willed a chapel wall of fresh, wet plaster to make the ephemeral hold still alongside the godly, the impalpable. Why would you paint a white square askew on a white background when you could go anywhere at all, encompass anything? If the world failed us, at least a painting might offer us its aggregate of rapture. I had a stake in this, longed to capture a bit of it myself, though my materials would be more modest, words instead of jewels, or at least exhaust myself in the attempt. I was a seasoned dreamer, and I dreamt, which sustained me for quite a number of years. But even the most stubborn of dreamers is forced to notice sooner or later that the world understands itself without her, albeit flattering intrusion. And it's a meager place once illusion in all its glory is exposed as sham. Besides, I've squandered poem after poem. Just think of all the treasure I've left stranded, uncultivated, the unattended but manifest allegiances in things. How a presence of its own accord sings right within my own field of vision, and I always fail to take it down. The year the snow came late, and the mountain was suddenly a tour de force of ermine, white on the golden residue of aspens. It's the winter slant of light that determines the color of their fur, and not the snow. Or a June hike, what, 15 years ago? The mountainside, a visual haiku. 5 mountain goats on the last patch of snow. And I would leave them there, forgotten. That is, until by accident I wandered into the wrong room at MoMA, turned around to a white square askew on a white background, and there were my mountain goats on snow. Kazimir Malevich had seen them too. How white craves white, how what's askew yearns for some congenial milieu where it can lose itself, disappear. Those stunning ermine, that snowless year, were neon on the gold leaves makeshift carpets, thrilling to witness, but ideal targets for even the most dull-eyed predator. Better to secure a sound white square, however unremarkable, unsubtle. A person has to settle for what's possible. A white square on a white background askew. 5 mountain goats on the last patch of snow.
Jacqueline Ashworo. She teaches English and creative writing at the University of Utah. Her most recent collection of poetry is called Ultimatum from Paradise. Thank you for coming by. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Yeah, we're done.
We're done.
Good job.
They're long, those poems. It's a long poem.
Radio okay. West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. Video West, produced by Josh Weathers. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.